We've been working with my book, A Burning Desire, and we were on the section about the, it's called the three characteristics of existence: suffering, impermanence, and not self. Well, sometimes impermanence usually comes first, but anyway, those three. And I'm going to take a little side trip from the book into early Buddhist teaching sutta that explores some of those ideas in the ancient texts. One of the suttas that I find particularly pleasing in its in the way it unfolds. So let's begin our sitting. So taking a posture that supports your awareness, supports your clarity and calm. And you can close your eyes, or if you're more comfortable with your eyes open, you can sit with your eyes open or just lower your gaze. There can be times when people get a little triggered with their eyes closed in meditation. So just to be sensitive to that. And then turning the attention inward. So just feeling the body. Might begin by just feeling how you're holding your body. It can actually be very revealing. We notice the habitual ways that we hold the body, whether it's, hunched over or rigid in some way, whether it's balanced or tipping one way or another. Meditation, mindfulness practice encourage us to find a kind of a neutral posture, one that's just very stable, upright, balanced. Can you feel your body as a living organism? Feel the life coursing through the body. And different areas of sensation, skin on the face, muscles in the belly, the hands, feet. And then using the breath to become more present, more awake. Just feeling the breath moving in and out of the body, moving through the body. As we settle the attention in the breath, you can quite naturally use that as a way to calm the body. Just releasing the breath and settling. what happens when you try that? Is there a settling in the body? Or perhaps there's some resistance. You might notice lingering tension. Our lives tend to create stress, and if we're not attentive, builds up. Meditating on the breath can help us to drain off some of that stress. We don't do that with too much of a goal in mind, like trying to force ourselves to relax. Really just feeling the breath can naturally have that impact if we just allow it, kind of non-interfering awareness. It's common as we begin to focus on the breath for thoughts to intrude. They might just pass through, so that we still can stay with the breath. But sometimes they'll completely hijack our attention. We'll find ourselves at some point down the road following, being carried by some stream of thoughts. So perhaps not a road, perhaps a river, whatever image suits. And that realization is a kind of waking up. We just come out of those thought streams. Remember, oh, I was meditating. We come back to the breath, come back to the body, come back to the here and now. This is much of our work, just the returning. We can keep the practice quite simple in that way. quite a lot can be revealed in that simple process. Mindful breathing. Awareness of thought. And coming back. We don't have to go searching for insights. Out of the calm that develops comes a clarity that allows us to see our own minds, to see our own experience, to see where we get stuck, caught, to see how we can let go. All right. Nice to sit together. And so, as I mentioned, I'm going to draw from one of the suttas, the early discourses of the Buddhas from this little gem, numerical discourses. It's an interesting collection in the way it's organized. You know, these early teachings weren't organized typically in ways that a modern teacher or scholar would organize anything. It's called the numerical discourses, and it starts with the book of the ones, the book of the twos, the book of the threes, up to the book of the elevens. And what those numbers represent are the number of topics or the number of items in a list that the Buddha talks about in the sutta, in each sutta. So it's kind of a random way of organizing things. There's just a ton of suttas in these, some of these in this book, and some of them are, you know, one paragraph. Many of them are quite short. And from what I've learned, they were one of the purposes of this collection was to be used by Buddhist monks to teach people, that they were kind of useful, short selections that the early monks could use as teaching tools. Whereas, you know, some of the suttas are very long and some of them are more elaborate or sort of narrative. So this one is the first one in the Book of the Nines, and each of the books has can have hundreds of suttas in it. There's actually one sutta in the Book of the Nines that I sometimes talk about that actually talks about one of the monks having to make amends. So for those who are in the 12-step world, you know that step nine is the amends step. And so I always found that helpful that the Buddha was working with the 12-step. And so I mean, it's interesting. It goes up to the 11s. You're kind of like, ooh, one more, and we could have really used this thing in the recovery world. I did a series on this some years ago, or I used it at a class I was teaching in Berkeley, and I was, each month I just used one or two suttas from the month, the numbered month. In any case, this sutta 9.1, first one of the nines, is called enlightenment, which I think makes it intriguing right away. It has this way that a lot of the suttas start, where it says, thus have I heard, and this is the voice of Ananda, who was the Buddha's attendant for the last 25 years of his life. And Ananda memorized a lot of the teachings so that after the Buddha died, that he was able to recite them. And then the whole community sort of memorized them from him. But the Buddha does this thing where it says he addressed the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus is a Pali word for monks. So, and it says bhikkhus, an exclamation point. And then it says, Venerable Sir, exclamation point, that the bhikkhus replied. And I was looking at it today and it was kind of like some kind of a call and response. You know, it didn't seem like it was just casual like bhikkhus. It seemed like bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, kind of, I don't know. I was reading about the song Shout by the Isley Brothers this afternoon. And that's a call and response, was written as a call and response. You make me want to shout, come on now, shout, come on. Bhikkhus, venerable sir. Anyway, I'm really losing the thread here, but I mean, because the Isley Brothers were a gospel group originally, so they were coming out of a religious tradition. So, okay, enough. Now, here's where this sutta starts out with what I find a very intriguing statement, and one that I think takes a little while to kind of figure out what it means. And the Buddha says, wanderers of other sects may ask you, what, friends, is the proximate cause for the development of the aids to enlightenment? And this is one of the sentences in the suttas that really, so what he's saying, if it's not obvious in terms of the sort of situation he's imagining, is, you know, there were a lot of different sort of sects, as he says, people following different teachings at the time, and there was sort of competition among them in ancient India. And so somebody might come along and say, you know, how do you get enlightened in your tradition? You know, and so the Buddha just sort of says this, and all the monks say, well, and he says, if you were asked this, how would you answer them? And the monks just go like, I know you're the teacher, you tell us, basically. But I want to go back to this phrase. What is the proximate cause for the development of the aids to enlightenment? Now, this word proximate is not one that I was particularly familiar with before before starting to study Buddhism. It can sound sort of like approximate, but it's like it's not the cause, but it's like a secondary cause or a necessary cause. I think it's Lee Brasington uses the example. He says, you know, turn on the lights in here. I flip a switch. But that's not really the cause for the lights. Like, the cause is that there's electricity and there's a power source and it's wired up, and, you know, it's this elaborate thing. But the proximate cause of the thing, like, okay, we need this thing to make the light go on. I don't know if that's exactly right, but I think it gives us an idea. So it's the proximate cause. But then it says, for the development of the aids to enlightenment. So it seems like we're a couple steps away from enlightenment here. He doesn't say, what's the cause of enlightenment? He says, like, what's the proximate cause? What are some of the things you need in order to develop the things that will help you to get enlightened? It's like, wow, it seems like we're really far away from it. So a very, very unusual phrase, and one, it's one I actually would like to talk to people who know more than me. But there's enough in this sutta that I think we can all understand that we don't need to know exactly why the Buddha is speaking in this kind of, you know, abstruse way. So what we know about the sutta, what do we know about the sutta? We know that there are going to be nine things because it's the nines. So start counting. Here, friends, a bhikkhu has good friends, good comrades, good companions. I'm sorry, I got that. Good friends, good comrades, companions, good comrades. This is the first proximate cause for the development of the aids to enlightenment. So another oddity of these suttas is the Buddha repeats himself. You know, there's a lot of redundancy. Good friends, good companions, good comrades, all the same thing. So the first thing we need in order to move towards enlightenment is good friends. And this doesn't mean like just like buddies that like want to go to the bar with you, you know. That would be lower companions. It's really when he's talking about good friends, he's really talking about spiritual companions, you know, people you can really trust, people who are going to support you on your path. And maybe even people that are further along the path than you, people that can help you. But one of the reasons I love this sutta is that this is the very first thing that the Buddha says we need. And in the recovery world, that's the very first thing that we find we need. We go to a meeting, you know, that's like the first step for most people in recovery. Rather than, you know, admitting we're powerless over alcohol, the formal first step, I think the first step is going and finding a community to support us. And we know that that's just kind of the key thing. It's very hard to get sober alone. And as the Buddha is saying, it's hard to become enlightened alone. No. Okay, so that's one. Then he says, here again, a bhikkhu is virtuous. And then he uses some technical language. He dwells restrained by the patimokkha, which is all the list of all the rules the monks follow. Possessed of good conduct, seeing danger in minute faults, having undertaken the training rules, he trains in them. This is the second proximate cause. So in simpler terms, we typically just talk about the precepts, to not kill, not to steal, not to harm sexually, not to lie or harm verbally, not to use intoxicants. So great. Like, again, I'm like, I'm on board with this because it's saying I need a community of support and I need to really live skillfully and non-harming and with ethics and morality, which is, again, like, that's recovery, right? We've got a lot of recovery here. Next, again, a bhikkhu gets to hear at will without trouble or difficulty. Talk concerned with, he says, the austere life that is conducive to opening up the heart. Talk on fewness of desires, on contentment, on not getting bound up with others. And he really winds up listing, says, arousing energy, virtuous behavior, concentration, talk on wisdom, on liberation. So he's listing basically the path, you know. So we go back to the beginning of this paragraph. A bhikkhu gets to hear at will without trouble or difficulty the Dharma, the teachings, the spiritual teachings. That makes sense, right? If you're going to develop any kind of spiritual path, you're going to have to get teachings. So you need the community, you know, the morality, and then access to the teachings to hear it. That's three. Again, friends, a bhikkhu has aroused energy for abandoning unwholesome qualities and acquiring wholesome qualities. This is called right effort, part of the Eightfold Path. So yeah, of course, we've got to have effort. If we just hang back and try to, you know, oh yeah, well, whatever, it'll take care of itself. No, nothing's going to happen. So that's four. Five, again, friends, a bhikkhu is wise. He possesses the wisdom that discerns arising and passing away, which is the Buddha's longhand for impermanence. Arising and passing away. So now we got five things. And I know it piles up and you won't have to, there won't be a quiz and you won't necessarily remember all of these, but you know, if we have the foundation, it's a good start. Community, morality, access to teachings, energy, making effort, engagement, and then seeing every impermanence. Now there's a twist. And this is what made me become such a fan of this sutta. So we've got the five. When a bhikkhu has good friends, good companions, good comrades, it can be expected that it will be virtuous, one who dwells restrained by the Patimokkha. When a bhikkhu has good friends, good companions, good comrades, it can be expected that he will get to hear at will the talk of the Dharma. When a bhikkhu has good friends, good companions, good comrades, it can be expected that he will arouse energy. When a bhikkhu has good friends, good companions, good comrades, it can be expected that he will be wise, possessing wisdom that discerns arising and passing away. So he's listed five, and it's like, well, it's supposed to be nine. Yeah, okay, we're going to get to nine. But before we go on, I want to tell you that those first five are all dependent upon the first one. That two, three, four, and five all come about because of having good friends, good companions, good comrades, because of having community. So he's pointing to the vital nature and the foundational nature of community in the spiritual path. That I just find so striking. All of this flows out of that, right? So then he fills in the rest. Some of these are, well, I'll just give them to you. Having based himself, I realized halfway through that I was just using the male pronoun all the time because that's what's here, but forgive me, forgive the Buddha, if you will. This has nothing to do with gender. Having based oneself on these five things, the bhikkhu or the meditator should develop further four things, because we got to get to nine. Six, the perception of unattractiveness should be developed to abandon lust. So that's typical of the way the Buddha talks to monks and nuns. But the point is, to see the unsatisfactory nature of sensual pleasure, that there's not enough drugs or booze or sex or food to ever satisfy you. That pursuing happiness through those, that form of craving is, you know, a fruitless path. So it's really about, we could simply say, about letting go of craving. So find a way to let go of craving. How can you do that? You know, and that's, of course, what we have to do as addicts is let go of that craving. And this idea, the Buddha says, to see the unattractiveness in it is one of the things that helps us, right? When we see ourselves wasted, you know, when we see other people wasted, you know, and we see what it's doing to our life, what it's doing to our body, what it's doing to our mind, it becomes unattractive. You know, there's a phrase in the Alcoholics Anonymous big book about we recoil as if from a hot flame. This is very much what the Buddha is talking about here, seeing the danger or the unattractiveness, the unsatisfactoriness of these things we crave. So that's six. So, and then we should develop this quality of seeing this, seeing the unsatisfactory nature of things. Seven, we should develop loving kindness to abandon ill will. So, you know, the traditional teaching says, you know, that the three poisons are greed, hatred, and delusion. So the greed or lust is let go of by the first thing, and then the ill will or the hatred is let go by loving kindness. Eight, we should develop mindfulness of breathing to cut off thoughts Well, that's very direct. You know, he rarely, it's the only place in the suttas, and I'm sure there's other places because I haven't read them all, but this is the one place that stands out to me where he makes this very specific purpose for mindfulness of breathing, because it's talked about in many different contexts, you know, but here he's saying develop mindfulness of breathing to cut off thoughts. I mean, that's kind of what we do, right? That's kind of like what we're taught. It's like the basic idea that sometimes we get more complicated with it, but when we come back to the breath, what we're doing is we're letting go of thoughts. Cutting off is sort of a strong for the language. I'd rather say develop mindfulness of breathing to let go of thoughts. And number nine, we should develop perception of impermanence to eradicate the conceit I am. When one perceives impermanence, the perception of non-self is stabilized. One who perceives non-self eradicates the conceit I am, which is nibbana in this very life. Whoa, that's how we got to enlightenment. Okay, so he packs a lot into number nine here. And it's interesting that, you know, number nine is developing the perception of impermanence. And I'm like, didn't we already do that? Because if you go back to number five, a bhikkhu is wise, possesses the wisdom that discerns arising and passing away. So interesting that it gets kind of recast here. And this is one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this sutta, and really what brought it to mind was when we were going through a burning desire this week, earlier in the week, we were talking about the connection between seeing impermanence and seeing not self. And the Buddha is making that explicit here. The perception of impermanence should be developed to eradicate the conceit I am. When one perceives impermanence, the perception of non-self is stabilized. So when you see that everything is constantly changing, you see that you yourself are also constantly changing, which means that there is no solid thing here that can be called a self. I mean, you can call it a self if you want to, but, you know, and that's fine. And certainly in, you know, ordinary language and ordinary understanding, of course, there's a self here, there's you there, I'm here, fine. But on the absolute level, if we really look at it, a self has to have some core, some solid thing that you can point to say, well, that's self. And the argument that the Buddha is making, and the foundation of this idea, that there, at least this way of getting into this idea of not self, is that if something is constantly changing, it can't be called a self. So everything about me is constantly changing on the mental, physical level. So that there's no self. So, and you know, you can fight that or overanalyze it. But what's more useful is to realize that if you can have this perception, you can experience enlightenment. The title of the sutta, one who perceives non-self eradicates the conceit I am, which is nibbana in this very life. So when we get rid of, and this word conceit is a technical term as well. It's not in English, you know, when we say you're conceited, it's like you have a high opinion of yourself. That's not what it means here. It's a belief, essentially a belief and even a misperception, you know, like we are confused or deceived by the illusion of permanence and the illusion of self. And that's a conceit. I am. Yeah. It's a belief. I believe it. I experience. That's how I feel it. That's how I'm perceiving it. And the Buddha says, if we look really closely, and this is why we have to develop very powerful and deep concentration through our meditation to see this so clearly. When we see on this microscopic level, atomic level, whatever level you can get to, the unstable nature, the constantly changing nature of mind and body, then there can come a moment when our, you know, solid, this construction we have of reality collapses. Because our perception of reality is a construction. It's based on conditioning and training, beliefs, misperception. And so, and it's deeply, we're very deeply conditioned into that. And so it requires getting to a place. Mindful breathing cuts off thoughts and impermanence becomes very, very clear, to the point that we see that there, everything that we had perceived as a self no longer is perceived in that way. That there's so fundamentally, there's a change in perception, which is really, I think, a good way of understanding enlightenment. So perception is how we name and interpret and understand the world around us. And it's very functional, you know. It's very helpful that I have this thing that I know that if I plug it into this thing here, that it'll pick up the sound of me speaking. And so I call it a microphone and it functions and it does all this stuff. But if I take it apart, I find that it's, as they say, it's made up of non-microphone parts, just as, you know, I am made up of non-self parts. When I shave or cut my hair, that thing that was me goes into the sink, is no longer me. That's because it was perceived as me. I perceive it as my beard or my hair, but that's just a convention. It's really not mine. It's not me. So, I mean, again, as I said before, you know, this can get into a lot of thinking, and I don't really want to stimulate a lot of thinking about not self. What I'd rather do, particularly for this group and for us as a community, is to remind you that what the Buddha says gets us on this path is us being together. That's a beautiful thing to me. You know? I don't have to be like, wait, how do I get my cut off my thoughts enough to be able to see impermanence? Am I looking close? I need to get more concentrated. Come on, how am I going to get in life? Just trust that if I engage in this process, that it's going to unfold in its own way, you know, and hopefully it's true that I have many lifetimes to do it in, because we're running out of time here. Thinking it might not happen. All right, my dears. So nice to see everyone. And we have some time left if anybody would like to chime in. Julie, hi.
Hello, everybody. I don't remember the exact wording of the sutta or the teaching, but Ananda says to the Buddha, something about the Sangha being half of this.
That's right. Half the holy life, he calls it.
The holy life, and Buddha saying it is the, anyway, you can, do you mind repeating that?
But yeah, I have right, exactly. Ananda says, you know, it's marvelous that that good friends and good companions are half the holy life. And the Buddha says, do not say that, Ananda. Good friends and good companions are the whole of the holy life. Yeah.
Sure. So that reminded me of that. And I am so happy to be here with this Sangha. Of course, I first went to thinking. And then you said, this is not about thinking. This is about us being together. And isn't that wonderful? So I'm going to say what my thought was and tell you how much it means to me to be here with you all twice a week. It means a lot. So I used to ask myself the question, what is my authentic self? And I realized recently that that really concretizes the idea of self. So I don't use that wording anymore because I resonate with the no self thing. However, in perceiving no self, in perceiving impermanence, etc., there is still the perceiver. What is perceiving? There is the perceiver and that which is perceived. How do I untangle myself from that?
Well, right. I can't tell you how to untangle yourself from that necessarily. But conceptually, let's say, or verbally, I can help sort that out.
Thank you.
The understanding is that consciousness itself is impermanent. So the perception is just arising with the object of perception. So there's a computer in front of me. My mind thinks, computer, I'm seeing that. I know, I'm aware that I'm aware, like, you know, that consciousness. But that's something that is also a flow. It's not a solid thing. However, it is the most it's the most convincing thing. When you really start to look, it's very hard to break away from the idea that your perception or your awareness isn't sort of a solid thing, you know? Or that it isn't who you are. Like, because it's like point of view, right? We're sort of, we feel like we're experiencing everything from this kind of place, you know, and through this lens. It's like, there's me. I remember being me before. I can imagine me being me in the future. And right now I'm me right here. And it's just all me. Because I can, and memory is a big part of that. And perception actually is, it's memory based, because I know this is a computer because I can remember it. I was told it. Like, and we know that when people lose their memory, they start to forget what things are, right? The objects don't stop being what they are and don't stop having the functions they have, but our ability to perceive them, to know what they are, you know, falls away. And so that's another way that we can see that perception is conditioned, it's impermanent.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that understanding, definitely the understanding of perception being conditioned, is, first of all, it's one of the things that psychedelics often reveal to people. You know, when you start seeing music, right? that like you realize, oh, and it's one of the things that kind of the psychedelic movement in the 60s, it's one of the reasons why that movement led some people to pursue a spiritual life, because they realized that their understanding of reality was just a construct, right? And so there's, you realize, oh, like this whole thing of like, because, you know, the sort of conventional understanding of reality is that, I mean, one of them is that the thing to do is accumulate a lot of things and experiences and power and, you know, the whole sort of capitalist model. And when people took LSD and were like, whoa, like, that's just like going nowhere, you kind of see that that's, there's no end game in that. That's just an empty, pointless exercise. You know, I don't mean to be promoting psychedelics, because I'm very much skeptical of their use at this point, but it is one of the things that can happen that helps people to see through the illusion of perception. So anyway, what I wanted to say, we don't need to take psychedelics if we understand this, and we remind ourselves, for, you know, as part of your practice, to remind yourself, like when you find yourself really caught up and like, oh man, I really need to have this car, or that's so terrible that, you know, whatever we're whatever we're attached to, right? When we find ourselves very attached to something, if we can step back and remember, like, this is like perception. I'm just believing this. I mean, the sports, great example, right? It's just like this thing, you know, because the wonderful thing about sports is that they don't try to pretend that they have meaning. No, they are literally games that are just totally artificial. And yet we find ourselves totally invested in them, right? Win, lose, and very much identity gets hooked up with it. You know, and we get happy when our team wins, sad when our team loses. You know, you see the people in Boston, you know, swearing at the Warriors players, you know, and all of that. And to just stop for a minute and go, you know, this is just a game, you know, and it's very much that is like a really good model for seeing reality, like how much of our life is a game, you know. And so reminding ourselves when we're being so caught up in a perception that we're creating suffering, or that we are experiencing suffering, and saying, oh, you know, is this reality that I'm responding to right now? Is this a construct? And much of the time we'll discover that it's a construct, that we need something to be a certain way. So, thanks to Julie, I have begun a new way of, at least a new approach to ending these sessions. So let's just, I'll ask you to just sit back for a moment. Take a breath. You can close your eyes or just sit. Body relax. I feel now that my shoulders got tense, talking, getting excited, breathing. And I think what I'm like to do is just suggest that you take this idea with you for the next couple of days of questioning perception. Just asking yourself, what is the reality that I am believing in right now that's actually just a construct? And what is really important? This is one of the ways that we can free ourselves moment by moment of the suffering of clinging that we all fall into. So I offer these teachings for your benefit. Hope they are useful and appreciate your support. And I will say good night. I will be here again on Tuesday. So be well.